Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. CPA Trendlines presents a production of the Center for Accounting Transformation. In a new age of watchmen, a team of individuals pooling their talents and abilities come together to bring analysis, reaction, and comedy to the fold. This is their chronicle. This is Accounting Arc.
Hello, and welcome to our first recording of ARC, Accounting Reactions. That's not right. What does ARC stand for again?
Accounting Analysis Reactions.
Analysis.
And comedy. And we've got the comedy in already. Great job.
Oh, I didn't do that on purpose, but you're welcome. That's me being awkward and making it comedic. So welcome to ARC, Accounting Reactions, Analysis, and that's wrong too. Guys, come on, help me out here. I'm gonna let Donnie do this.
This is way welcome too much to fun Art just watching you.
Accounting, Analysis, Reactions, and Comedy, which we definitely have a lot now at podcast.
Oh, I was just doing that for the outtakes, right? That's the point. So today we're talking about SVB, which has been kind of a hot topic for many different perspectives in our industry. And we've brought in an amazing special guest, Terry. So would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm Terry Sherrill, currently a financial accounting director at TPS Thayer in Sugarland, Texas. My background is varied, but my love and where I started out was in internal audit with banks. I've worked at small community banks, larger commercial banks, and regional international banks. But I also took that knowledge with respect to internal controls and banking into learning how to offer internal audit services on an outsourced basis with banks. So I've worked in public accounting, offering outsourced internal control consulting services for banks. So I've been involved both as an internal auditor, an operations officer at a community bank level, as well as an internal audit director for large publicly traded banks, as well as small community banks.
So the TLDR on Terry is she's worked at every size bank. She's done internal audit. She's also worked in big public accounting firms. She's built CAS practices. So she understands this from both sides, the internal bank side, the external bank side, as well as the public accounting perspective. So pretty much we can just let her talk the whole time and we can just ask questions and learn.
That makes our job easy.
Yeah, that's why we get really...
Wait a minute.
Yeah. We get really intelligent guests, right? So that we can just be the comedy part of it, or at least that's my role, right? I think it's really good to start with what actually happened, right? So we've had the first bank failure in years, and it was kind of unexpected and happened over like a 5-day period. So that story was really interesting and fascinating. So Donnie, do you want to take that?
Sure. From the things that I listened to, it really was the bank run. and we haven't heard about this in a long time, like you said, since, what was it, 2008 was the last time we had that banking crisis and everything.
Right. And it was Washington Mutual, actually, in 2008. And that was the largest bank failure in U.S. history. So the one with Silicon Valley Bank is now the second largest. So yeah, it's been a little quiet since 2008.
That's a good thing. We like consistency with our banks. Yeah. So from my personal experience, it was really interesting because we were getting emails and calls from investors because we work with a lot of tech companies, and a lot of tech companies have their money at Silicon Valley Bank, or I should say had, although they're still kind of operating under a new guise, but that's a leader conversation. So we got calls from investors saying, get all of our investment money out of Silicon Valley Bank. And we're going, okay, how? Because while we've advised these companies to open multiple bank accounts, they didn't. And setting up a bank account in 24 hours and transferring $3 million, it's not that easy. And so that was happening across the country. Everyone with money there was going after that. They had their investor call. They were saying, get your money out. And the VCs really fueled this run on the bank that was insane.
I totally agree. That was the whole interesting thing. And I think that's the interesting thing when you read through a lot of the how people discuss this. Like, it's not that the bank was actually failing. It failed because of all of the stuff or all of the depositors that had money that started pulling it out. They probably would have been okay if nobody had done anything. I don't know. Is that true?
Yeah. And like you guys, I had a client too, and they had $7.5 million at Silicon Valley Bank. And we were advising them the same way. Like, you need to make sure that you move your funds and that type of thing. But, you know, with respect to this, you know, venture capital, obviously, probably since probably around 2018, that was the tech companies were being funded by those for quite some time. And so there was a lot of venture capital that was going into funding those small tech companies, and especially in the Silicon Valley area. And what was the big push was them putting deposits in. So if you look back at the history of them, they probably had about 56 maybe billion dollars in deposits in 2018. By 2021, they had $191 billion in deposits. So in that short period of time, that money was deployed in by those tech companies, and the deposits were being made there. During those times when you had basically zero interest rates, because there was not many payments or anything being made, then that was probably a pretty safe situation for those customers to be in and to have their money in, even though obviously they were over the $250,000 FDIC insurance limit. And so, and you know, they could then invest. So banks have to do something with those deposits because they're not really going to make any money there. They keep a certain amount, obviously, there on tap for them to fund customers that come in, paying and receiving, those kind of things. But basically, they're wanting to make loans and invest that money in ways that they can. And so here they are sitting at, you know, over $220 billion, and the economy starts changing. And there's inflation and interest rates start increasing. So now you've got these small tech companies that need access to money, and they're not getting it for venture capital anymore. So some of the funding sources start drying up. So they've got to figure out a way to fund their operations. So they're going out and drawing on their money. And so they're going and getting their deposits then out of Silicon Valley. And at the same time, the Fed, in their infinite wisdom, and you know, I know they know what they're doing, but they're trying to offset the recession by increasing interest rates. And so where Silicon Valley had put their money out, they had put their money in long-term treasury bonds that were they were okay from an interest rate standpoint, but they were investing, or what their collateral was mortgage-backed securities. And so those are like 30-year terms, I mean, out there. So it's long-term. And so that's what their securities were in, and their investments were in. So when interest rates started going up, the value, obviously, of those bonds started declining. And so they need to sell those off because they've got now the demand on the deposits and things coming in from their customers, their tech customers. They got to find a way to fund those. And basically, it's a liquidity issue because they've got their money in these long-term treasuries. And so they start selling them off. And as the, you know, as we all know, with respect to, you know, social media and access to things that our customers all have now, people are seeing in the market that they're selling off these treasury securities. And so that, again, causes a bit of a panic in the market because they're saying, why are they selling off these securities? And so that same, that really was kind of a trigger then. And because things are so quick now, then your depositors started drawing down their funds and pretty much caused that run on the bank. And so, and we can all see because of access and things like that, then in a very short period of time, those funds can be drawn down. And basically, the banks don't keep that much cash on deposit. So there's no way for them to fund it. So they basically became illiquid.
Right. So there's been, you know, a lot of criticism in our industry around, you know, saying Silicon Valley Bank was way over leveraged. The auditors should have caught that. They should have put a going concern on there. There's been a bunch of, you know, I would say, reactions to this particular event criticizing this industry, because, you know, everyone has this picture in their head of somebody with a green visor sitting in the back of the bank calculating out the ratios they need and making sure, you know, there's enough cash or this investment is right, or, you know, they're offering the best lowest interest rates to their investors to get more deposits and kind of playing that game out in here. But what would you say is truly, you know, is this an issue with the CPA profession? Was there an audit or miss? Was there a bank issue? Or was it truly, you know, all of these circumstances combining to create the perfect storm?
Yeah, it's so funny because, you know, I've lived through a few of these things happening, right? I mean, so you go into the 80s, you know, and what happened with the financial crisis in the 80s, you go into 2008 and then the subprime mortgage lending and everybody, and then now again in 2023, and everybody wants to find somebody to blame for how this happened. And so, you know, so I think it is a perfect storm from us, you know, from a certain standpoint. I mean, obviously it's the market and the conditions in the market. It was their decision from a risk perspective as to how they were investing in their portfolio. So it probably, and I mean, they were looked at by regulators. My understanding too is that regulators had made recommendations to them. That bank typically was slow to respond. And so again, like what's the impetus then to get them to do what they need to do? But I think probably from a root cause perspective, it probably is a lack of management understanding, and the regulations are there. There's you know, all sorts of models to stress test your bank from an asset liability quality standpoint, and so I think it probably comes down to the root cause is just management decisions with respect to how they were going to run their portfolio, their liquidity. They had too much of a concentration with respect to the tech industry. And we all are warned about that, is to not have concentrations in your customer portfolio and things like that. So I think ultimately, it's probably going to come down to inadequate management with respect to their strategic objectives, with respect to their with respect to interest rate risk, liquidity risk, and just managing their assets so they didn't have this type of event. I mean, I really think that probably, when I look back at it from a root cause perspective, is going to come down to poor management.
Well, and I think you nailed it when you mentioned the concentration of risk in the tech industry, particularly the venture-backed tech industry, because, you know, if you think of that space, I spent some recent years in the venture-backed startup.
He did some
world.
Time.
I did some time. That's a really great one. I'm going to use that line from now on, Liz. I did some time in the venture-backed startup world. And, you know, part of that culture, that world, is moving quickly, leveraging technology, high collaboration. And the way this happened really was the function of a small group of venture funds telling their portfolio companies, get your shit out as quick as possible. And it turned into everybody telling everybody within that venture-backed space to pull their money out, ironically speaking, you know, it's all kind of the same pool of venture-backed funds that they're all trying to, you know, it's like 50 dogs in one stake all pulling at the same stake. And, you know, then you have the tech industry leveraging technology to be able to move the funds very quickly, rather than if it's, you know, your Main Street, you know, businesses, they're going to go stand in line at the bank in order to make wire transfers and things. So I really believe that any bank that has a high concentration of these types of businesses has risk of an accelerated run far beyond anybody else who even may be, you know, very stable and healthy as a bank.
That makes a ton of sense. And, you know, that makes me start to wonder, and I'm actually going to look at Liz and Terry, because yeah, I also don't do traditional accounting anymore, but I'm hearing the dollar amounts, and I keep coming back to, okay, FDIC insurance limit is 25,000. So why would you ever put more than 25,000 in a single bank?
250,000
investments, but in banks, like what is this? What would you guys normally, is this what you advise the startups or?
Absolutely not. So the 250,000 FDIC limit is really important. And it's an important metric for companies to understand, because, you know, there is risk there. But, you know, I think going back to what Terry said and what Byron said, like, this bank was very specific in the way that they operated, right? And they were catering very specifically to an industry. And even more specifically, the majority of the VCs that put their money there were based in California, right? And so, you know, it's location specific as well. And so there's a couple different niche items happening here. So I'm going to go back to, like, when we talk to clients, we tell them you need at least two bank accounts. There's a risk associated with having only one bank account. If you have more cash than 250,000, we talk about sweeps accounts. We talk about investing in their own treasury bills, you know, to get some interest in some pretty low risk items, right? And we just talk about general cash management and advise our clients not to do that. Now, our clients also are tech companies with VCs backing them. So if their VC says, you will keep the $5 million I'm investing into your company in SVB, they're going to do it. And SVB was offering interest rates to make it lucrative for them. So while I'm saying invest in T-bills, the interest rates SVB are offering are almost the same. And they have the pressure of their investor coming down and saying, no, you need to keep your money here because this is where our relationship is. And this is how we're going to further that money for our own benefit, right? And those VCs at the same time are getting discounted rate mortgages, discounted rate loans. They're getting all sorts of, you know, benefits for the relationship. Now, do I think that those benefits for the relationship were to the extreme where it took down the bank? Absolutely not. Do I think they were probably not the right thing to do? Absolutely. But then, you know, like thinking about it holistically, so you have all this pressure coming down, you have these companies saying, okay, well, this is what I'm going to do because this is what my investor is saying. And I don't care if you're my fractional CFO, like that's where the money's coming from is more important than your advice in this moment. And that was what happened to a significant number of our clients. And then on the flip side, when you're looking at the bank in total, you know, that concentration was on purpose. This was a bank founded in 1983 specifically to focus on technology development. And that, you know, in the 80s was not really a big industry. It was a very small, close-knit group of people. It was just kind of at the very beginning. And they survived a few different banking crises and a few different crashes of the tech industry in total without issue until this year. That's insane that they went through those cycles and were totally fine. So the concentration risk, I don't think is the risk that took them down, because they've been operating in that concentration risk for almost 40 years.
That makes me think like it's the VCs. I hate to say it, but the VCs end up being the problem there, right? Because they're the ones forcing the companies to take the risk. Because everyone points to SVB and everyone, like they were wrong. It actually sounds like the VCs were wrong in this one.
I absolutely agree, Donnie. I mean, I can tell you very confidently there were startups holding tens of 20s of $30 million in savings accounts, based on the direction of, you know, the people they trusted, oftentimes the people who gave them that money to spend. And I would also add, though, I think I also wonder where the financial advisors were for the internally. So obviously, like Liz said, like her clients, they were advising certain things, but many of these startups also have, I'm going to do air quotes, CFOs, because I have opinions there, who, you know, I don't think really have the knowledge or experience to properly advise based on sound business practices. And they weren't in there, you know, helping to manage that risk.
Yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I mean, I hear you're saying and what your point is, but from the financial institution standpoint, right, that's government backed. And the people that work there have an obligation, like from a regulatory standpoint, to be in compliance with regulations. And so even though, as you said, like it was a tech bank, they still are responsible for diverse, making sure that the portfolio is diversified and things like that. Like they have a regulatory requirement and commitment to keep to maintain diversity in the portfolio. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying, I guess, Liz and Byron, but I feel like from the other step, and I know there's pressure from those tech companies because the VC is saying, hey, you need to put your money in this bank, but the bankers have an obligation and the regulators, because they are going to insure deposits. And in this, you know, if $250,000, or more, when, you know, again, people are going to come in and step in and take care of that when things happen. So I mean, I hear what you're saying, but at some point, don't you think the bank has a responsibility for ensuring some type of diversity? I mean, from a regulatory standpoint, they're committed to doing that. So to a certain extent, I kind of come back to management for the banks again, because they were really out of compliance with what their charters say, who funds them say, because I mean, they're a Federal Reserve Bank. I mean, that's who authorizes them to exist. So, I mean, I can say, yeah, VCs have a part in it, but I feel like the gatekeepers are the financial institutions, and this is federally insured funds. So to a certain extent, the management of that organization has a commitment to me from a rules and regulation standpoint.
Actually, I kind of like this, because, you know, in the beginning we talked to, everyone's trying to point fingers like who's wrong. But what I'm actually hearing is there is a little bit of wrong in all of the different pieces. So the bank had its responsibilities that it didn't do. The VCs had their, I'm not going to call it responsibility, but their influence on this, which caused certain actions to occur. And then there was the, I'm going to use Byron's air quotes, CFOs of the tech companies that also didn't really do their job in really ensuring and looking out what's best. Because I'm hearing too, like even Liz, to her clients, we were advising them and they decided not to listen to our advice. And so she's getting overridden, or her team's getting overridden by the own founder, whoever. That is kind of going back to the VC. So I'm hearing a lot of just kind of blame or fault all around. And it's not like it's one thing. Because one thing that's driving me kind of nuts on this is everyone's trying to look for that one thing. Well, this is who we blame. Yeah. But it sounds like, and Liz kind of said it earlier, it's almost like a perfect storm of a lot of people kind of did the wrong thing.
Well, so I'm going to push back on the management side. Like, I totally agree with you, Terry, in that they have regulatory and requirements that they have to actually comply with and should be thinking about. And also, their mission and vision was to create a best-in-class customer service bank for the tech industry. So is there a space at all for a bank to provide that type of industry specific customer service? Or are we saying regulatorily and also, you know, in this current economy, in this situation, in this country, and whatever we want to call it, that's not a thing that's ever going to happen? Because on top of this, we have really horrible customer service from most of our banks. And this bank was willing to step out, build relationships, offer credit to startups that otherwise wouldn't get it, you know, create banking, you know, models for this particular industry that was completely underserved because they were considered too high risk, right? Mm-hmm. So they did take a lot of risk to do that. And also, is there a space for that at all?
And in doing that, are we willing then to pay the consequences, I guess, right? By kind of putting our eggs all in one basket, or when market conditions or environmental conditions impact a particular industry, that we're going to, there, you know, what goes up must come down. Like that there will, there could, there, you are taking that risk. I mean, there are other banks, obviously, that have to cater to their local communities. Obviously, I mean, you know, like you said, it was it's Silicon Valley. You know, that's where tech is. So they obviously were serving their community from that perspective and offering service. So there is something to be said for that. I mean, there's women-owned businesses, there's Black-owned businesses. So, I mean, from a banking standpoint, I hear what you're saying. I think there's obviously banks and they have the commitment to serve their local communities as well. So, I mean, they need to be doing that. I just think if you look at a bank as a business or one of your clients, you probably wouldn't advise them to stay in one particular thing. I mean, I think diversification is something from a product and services standpoint that you need to consider to weather a whole lot of storms. Like, it just makes business sense, even if it's not from a regulatory perspective.
Yeah, well, and I think it's really fascinating here too, because this particular bank harkens back to like the late 1800s and the early 1900s, right? In that they had really high deposits in very specific concentrations. And, you know, I think a lot of that is because they were willing to take additional risk and kind of bend the rules in a way that clearly ended poorly. And also, you know, I think the intention there was actually pretty good. And that's the part that's hard, right?
Yeah. And do we know if Silicon Valley had been, cited for being out of compliance? And I don't even know what the rules are related to their portfolio diversification, but had regulators, had the FDIC told them, or was that cited in their audit as something that was a risk or they were out of compliance on? I had not heard that previously.
In my research, I just saw that they had examination comments. I didn't go specifically into what those were, but they were very slow to respond to regulatory issues. And so that's kind of from the Federal Reserve. And I mean, again, having worked with banks from a regulatory perspective, you can go year after year and not do what the regulators say, it doesn't go for very long because, right, they give you the right to do business. So at some point, it's going to hit the fan and they're going to put you under some type of regulatory order so that you will behave and you will do what they say that they're going to do. I don't know that I would. I don't know. I mean, it's all that oversight, just like Liz was saying. They've had regulators in there. They've had accounting firms give opinions in there. And then in 5 days, you know, basically this happened.
Well, and that's, you know, I setting all of that aside, I just I wonder if every bank out there is at risk due to just the speed at which depositors can move money today. And if they need to build some new safeguards in place to account for that, I mentioned earlier, community banks might actually just have a line out the door where SVB and Brex and, all of these, digital banks, there's no line. It's all virtual moving money. And I just think that because the lines are we're no longer limited to bank tellers, throttling the speed at which cash can leave the bank vault, that any bank out there is currently at risk of having some sort of run if a social call to action is made that catches fire to withdraw your funds.
Well, and I mean, it's a good point. And just like you said, with runs on the bank, what they call is a contagion happens after these things. And some of those things Signature Bank and some of the ones that kind of were in that same world, basically that run or what happened with Silicon impacted the ability for those banks too, because people start seeing that action and think they need to get their money out too. Specifically banks they're doing a disservice to themselves and everybody else if they keep that much cash on hand, right? It's not prudent. And in the past, you couldn't put it anywhere to earn much of anything anyway. But they don't carry that much cash. I mean, it's just not there. And so whether or not some type of, again, and I hate to impose some other type of regulations again, but should everybody feels like if I've got that money, $7.5 million, it better be there and I want it out today. But should there be restrictions to say this just isn't feasibly possible, or the impacts to the market and what things will happen are too critical that we may need to put some type of provisions in place to reduce the amount that customers could get out in any one period of time to prevent some of that risk or exposure and hysteria on other financial institutions.
Well, it's really interesting. Do you guys remember when Robinhood put a halt trade on GameStop because of the Reddit blow up? So regulators on the stock market can put, stop trading on any particular trading that's happening. It could be, a bank, or it could be just in general, you cannot trade that day. They can close the exchange, right? And they do that to avoid mass hysteria, right? So that's been, implemented due to technology, right? A thing that happened that people freaked out about because it limited an open market. So is that something that we could see kind of roll over into the banking side versus just the investment side?
I think it's a relevant question that I have to assume yes. They've got to do something to hit the pause button and allow, maybe the emotions to simmer before, these types of things happen, because it just moves too quick.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think, what's really important is how does our profession respond to this, right? We need to move forward. And this is a great reminder that you can't really trust banks, right? You can to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, the FDIC insurance exists for a reason, right? There's a good reason it exists. And a lot of people have gotten very comfortable trusting the institution. And so, at this point in time, how do we advise clients moving forward? What type of professional skepticism should we put on things? And how do we talk about choosing a bank in general? And what should that process look like?
Well, even from a banking standpoint, banks do their due diligence on where they're going to put their funds, right? So they have a whole regulation that says that they've got to look at intercompany liabilities and the financial strength of those organizations that they do business with. And our customers need to be doing the same thing. Chase was involved recently in helping with another financial institution and a buyout for them as well. Chase is definitely, and I hate to use this phrase, but are they too big to fail? And if your money's at Chase, are you any less risky than your money being at Silicon Valley Bank? So again, I think, what would you do? You're going to look at financial capacity. And so, you know, mostly publicly traded banks, even community banks, you have access to their financial information and their financial statements that probably as part of just like how customers do due diligence on their vendors. You ought to be doing due diligence on your banking institutions, your depository institutions as well, and look at what their, have a practice in place to look at what their financial strengths are and monitor what those institutions' performance are so that you're looking, you know, that at least you're evaluating the health and strength of those organizations that you're keeping your most liquid assets at.
That makes a lot of sense. The other thing that I got from, and I think it was Liz, actually it was Liz and Terry, both of you kind of, some of your interchange was this whole understanding of risk and really understanding concentration of risk. And I don't necessarily want it regulated per se, but that as a good management practice, which is something that as accountants and auditors, we can influence and ask questions about, we really need to raise this concentration of risk question up more and look at it beyond kind of the historical way we've looked at it. Because I like Liz's example of like, this is like a double niche type of bank that's serving this. And so how does that actually change the risk profile? I maybe can't do my standard analysis, or the fact that there's customers that have this much more above FDIC, that's a different type of risk, which I don't know if they actually test that as part of the, when they look at liquidity and things, because that's a different profile of customer as well.
Right. And again, kind of going back, sorry, but it kind of has triggered me on that when we talk about responsibility again, but with respect to concentration of risk and that they needed to be, I believe there is something to serving your community and having organizations that understand the industries in which that they work, but they didn't have to put all of their investments into long-term treasury bonds. I mean, so that is a choice that they made. Had they done something in short term, you may not have seen what you saw with respect to that, because it really was the access. So there were decisions there from a management standpoint. And when we talk about risk, and in that case, you know, liquidity risk, that they could they needed to make provisions for a good mix with respect to what their assets were. And so to make the decision to put as much as they did into, you know, a long-term obligation may not have been an appropriate decision for their risk profile and who their customers were. And again, with the economy and the access to cash, you know, the tech customers were coming and getting money out. I mean, that's what they needed to operate. So I think there's a whole, I mean, I guess, Donnie, I'm saying, you know, our customers have risk profiles that they need to look at as well into, you know, where they're putting their, probably their liquidity risk, where they're putting their cash from an organization, their diversity from a product standpoint and a customer standpoint, the reputational risk and things like that, that come up with respect to clients. And even if it's not true, what the market's saying about them from a reputation standpoint, because that again can influence a business's ability to do work and attract customers. So I think those kind of things that you're bringing up probably is a key kind of core management or tone at the top governance, probably per se, from an internal controls standpoint, that our customers should be aware of.
Well, and I think, you know, I've spent almost my entire career talking about a tech stack. And what we need to start talking about is a banking stack, where we are evaluating multiple, you know, providers, multiple solutions. You know, I know that we're starting to see, they've probably been around, but probably underutilized, these solutions that help mix up that cash portfolio and spread it across multiple institutions. So I think the conversation that we need to start having is related to that banking stack with our clients.
Well, and so, you know, furthermore on that front, like those tech banks, right? So those are not, they don't necessarily have their own banking charter, right? They're not regulated banks. They are a technology that sits on top of the banking industry that then you put your money in electronically and they spread it out. You don't even know where your money is per se. They put it into diversified accounts. Generally, those particular tech solutions offer a million, 2.5 million, and some of them even up to like 150 million in FDIC insurance by effectively creating API connections to other banks and opening a ton of accounts and sweeping your cash there every day. And so when you're looking at your cash balance, you're looking at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 accounts. It depends on how much money you have in the bank. And do we trust the technology to do that correctly? Is that something that we should be advising clients? Hey, go look at this. Like, this is pretty cool. It is really cool. It's really interesting. It's a fantastic solution when insurance limits haven't been increased at the rate of inflation. And so we have these super low insurance limits that were never intended to stay that low as a percentage of what we have. But at the same time, are we going to trust the technology to do it right and hold our money safe?
That's an interesting concept, I think. You know, that And probably the solution, because I kept thinking that too. Like, okay, I can understand though, because if I have that much money, and now I got spread across this many banks, now I got to do this many bank recs or whatever it is, right, to manage all that and move all the money, and that's a pain. So, but if there was a technology solution that really did that, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah,
there's multiple. There's a bank called Bella. There's a bank called Thread. Then there's a bunch of other options, you know, where people are working on this, and other tech enabled banks that have, you know, their back end being a chartered regulated bank, but their front end being a technology solution. Right. But when you look at that, is it trustworthy? It makes the accounting way easier, right? Because then you have one account that you're getting connected into your accounting record. So all the transactions are flowing through a nice, beautiful interface that's integrating. It looks beautiful. It functions very much how you would expect an online portal of one bank account to look. However, your money is not there. Your money is spread out in all of these different accounts in all of these different banks across the country. So, Terry, I'd be curious what your opinion is of that. And if you think potentially regulators will start regulating that level of technology versus just the banks underneath it all.
I think that they probably are going to have to start auditing, regulating, examining that level of technology. And again, not to speak bad of, you know, federally insured financial institutions, but they're probably a little slower from a technology perspective than obviously their customers are, and particularly their technology customers. They've got to get up to speed with respect to those kind of things. But so I would say they're going to have to get there. They're going to have to look at what are the implications from a security perspective. And Donnie, you get on it, you know, you're very familiar with those kind of things, but they're going to have to be aware from a security perspective. I mean, safeguarding privacy issues, those kind of things that financial institutions are constantly confronted with. And with respect to what you're saying, with respect to, you know, IPS and CDRs and those kind of investment vehicles, I mean, I think it's a great vehicle to be able to put your money out to all these other financial institutions. I think it's good for the financial institutions. I think it's good for the consumer because now they really do have access to funds that are more secure, that are insured, that they've spread that risk out again. So again, Liz, I think that it helps also address some of the risk issues with respect to where you're putting your funds by being able to sort those out. But then the simplicity of it's all in one account that you're reconciling at the end of the day. So I think this presents a lot of opportunities to help think about control. The the storm, the great storm that we had here. And that while it is not any one, it's not any one person's fault, that it's obviously a lot of things that we had. I mean, it's the industry, it's the VCs, it's banking in general, it's customer awareness and support that, and it's technology. And I think as we're finding, you know, even with AI and things like that, we don't always do a good job of looking at what are those implications and considerations of implementing something that is so quick and efficient and functions for us and makes our life easier.
Well, and I think the irony of all of it is, you know, we live in a country where free banking was kind of built in, right? So that we could have capitalism and we could have industry and we could build, right? And so we ended up with thousands of banks and a big regulatory body and more regulations being put upon it over and over and over again. And it's still backed by the government. At the end of the day, all of the SVB deposits were still backed by our government. Yet, you know, the complications of our banking industry are so massive and the complications it creates from a business perspective, even to make sure that you're keeping your funds secure and you understand where they're going and how it's working. You know, it's overcomplicated in a way that's really fascinating and also creates the ability for failure and for too concentrated risk. Yet, at the beginning of all of this, the goal was to have more free cash flow and more money going back into local economies versus being regulated by the government level. Yet we're there with thousands of banks versus other countries that made the decision to start with government regulation and government-backed banks, who ended up with 5 or 10 banks total, with way less, you know, complication and way fewer risks associated with it as well. So I just think it's ironic and funny that that's the state that our country is in and the state of our banking industry when the intention was the complete opposite.
Yeah, and I don't suspect Alexander Hamilton was really seeing the future as to where this could go.
Right. And I mean, again, and we haven't really touched on it too much because there was an attempt to deregulate back in 2018, but that was for the $250 billion or less, which obviously Silicon Valley Bank fell within that. But I don't believe, and I think Donnie said that too, I don't believe in if something happens, we need to regulate it or over-regulate it. And so I don't want that. I hope that the answer to our conversation today is not we need more regulation, because, and especially not from the standpoint, because I'm going to hold true to those community bankers down there who do a fantastic job every day serving their communities. And they do not want the regulatory burden of what these super, you know, international banking organizations have. They don't need it. They don't want it. They can't afford it to do their job well. So I'm not going to purport more regulation at this point as the answer. But I think awareness, the rules are in place. We have to be thoughtful and make good decisions. And we also need to be, I mean, again, aware of the technology and the speed of which things can happen, which is, you know, a blessing and a curse.
Harry, I think you summed it up so well. It really is just, we all need to take the time, think through these things. Some of what we would have called common sense, which we know is not that common. So maybe better business practices on how we manage this stuff. So with that, like, we're pretty much out of wrap. And so Terry, from all three of us, really thank you for joining us. You've brought like the wealth of information about this industry, which I've known you for a long time now, and I knew you would do that. So thank you for joining us and sharing all of your thoughts there. For all the listeners out there, I hope that you guys enjoyed our first edition. I hope you got some analysis. We definitely had a bunch of reactions. We don't know what your reactions are, but we'd love to hear from you on that. And of course, we had a good time laughing, especially in the beginning with Liz trying to say the whole company. So thank you everyone for joining us, and hope we'll see you on the next podcast.
Y'all.
The Center for Accounting Transformation provides business professionals with a network for utilizing innovations that are ready for adoption, the training and resources necessary to apply those innovations, and an opportunity to engage the talent and community needed to further the pursuit of innovative accounting practices that drive responsible and mindful business performance. Find out more at our website, www.improvetheworld.net. And if you're interested in sharing your own transformation stories, please contact us there.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPAtrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to CPAtrendlines.com.